Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
If I could talk to the animals, just imagine it, chatting with a chimp and chimpanzee. Imagine talking to a tiger, chatting with a cheetah. What a neat achievement it would be. If we could talk to the animals, learn all their languages, maybe take an animal degree. I'd study elephant and eagle, buffalo and beagle, alligator, guinea pig, and flea.
Did you know that ants teach? Earthworms make decisions, dolphins are self-aware, rats love to be tickled, or chimps grieve. Or that dogs have thousand-word vocabularies and birds practice songs in their sleep. In the book Animal Wise, the thoughts and emotions of our fellow creatures, it takes us on a surprising and enlightening odyssey into the minds and emotions of animals through the unusual, curious, and committed researchers who study them. It is a great pleasure to welcome the author of Animal Wise, Virginia Morell, to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
How did you come to this particular subject of looking at the thoughts and emotions of, as you say, our fellow creatures?
I was interested in the way that my dog had invented a game. She dropped a pine cone over a hill one day as a puppy and chased and waited till it got to a certain speed. And you could see the expression on her chase sort of change from puppy, pet, you know, to a wolfy predator. And I thought she had obviously invented this game. She played it every time we'd hike up this one trail where there was a very steep portion and she could drop her pine cone down the hill and wait till it looked to her like a prey animal and then chased after it. So she had an imagination, and I then was surprised at myself that I didn't think, well, before, that why wouldn't a dog have an imagination? I mean, dogs play all sorts of games with us where they're pretending to be kind of a mean, growly dog, but they're wagging their tails at the same time. So that obviously takes some cognitive abilities, and then I was out with a lot of different animal researchers for the work that I do for Science and National Geographic and just encountered various situations from chimpanzees to elephants to cheetahs that made me realize, as the scientists talked about them, that the scientists themselves regarded the animals as thinking, emotional beings.
I do think it's easier, I mean, for most people, and I felt this way in reading the book, that I can understand it when you see those human-like qualities. It's easier for us to understand that case in dogs or in parrots or in chimps and even dolphins, but maybe less so in ants or fish.
Yes. Fish have a real disadvantage because their faces are immobile. You know, I mean, it helps if you're going to live in water, you want to be as sleek and as missile-like as you possibly can be. So you don't want a lot of wrinkly, smiley expressions to mess up that sleekness. Dolphins, of course, have an advantage because the shape of their mouth makes them look like they are smiling all the time. But a fish has an immobile face, and so it's very easy to think, well, there's not a thought going on in their head. And what researchers have found, of course, is that there's everything from parental care to tool use to actually some species working together to go hunting. There's a wrasse that will go find a moray eagle and show it where the fish has found another little fish hiding in a rock and sort of point the eel to it so the eel can flush it out, which is the way that we use dogs. So there's a lot of these things that we don't imagine another species having, but if you spend the time either to look at them or to give them challenge tests, as this researcher does in England with his ants, you can find out a lot more about their decision-making process.
I guess that is what is fascinating in reading the book, is that it's safe to say that somewhere around the world there is a scientist in a lab that is researching some creature, whether it be ants or elephants or dolphins or turtles, and they're trying to figure out what they're thinking, what they're doing, and why.
Yes. Yeah, and how they go about it. And a lot of what goes on in every animal's mind, from human to ant, is a kind of a decision-making which is probably best compared to what computers do, you know, so that there are rules. If you find yourself in a particular situation, there are rules for making decisions so that you can do them quickly. And oftentimes we regard those as just instinctive behaviors, but that's a shortcut to thinking fast. And so you can take these, you can put ants, for instance, in a situation where you destroy their homes and then watch as they regroup and have to go find a new home. And if you give this test enough times with under the same setup over and over again, you can then find out what they require in a home, how they regroup, what steps they take first to solve this problem that they're faced with.
That whole idea of animal cognition is often downplayed. Why do you think that is?
I think it's to our advantage to assume that other animals around us don't have thoughts. We don't really want to feel that we're causing animals to suffer, and yet we do. You know, we use them in ways that if you regard animals as having minds or the ability to feel pain and to suffer from that pain, then some of the things that we do to animals aren't exactly kind. We use them in some very cruel medical experiments. We've used them for cosmetic testing in often cruel ways. And so I think one of the things from my book is that if we are going to take a new look at the minds of other animals around us, that we will probably want to rethink how we use other animals. And this isn't to say that we should stop or that we shouldn't have farmed animals or, if necessary for medical discoveries, to use animals in that research, but that we want to be kind as we use the animals. We want to make sure that they're housed properly, that they're cared for kindly during their lives, because they're giving their lives in essence to ours. And I think that's something that most people would probably agree with.
I do agree with that. My problem is that it still ends up often in the animal dying.
Yes, it either ends up in great harm to the animal or in the animal dying. And in the case of medical research, for instance, my great hope is that eventually we get to the point where many of these studies need only be done on cells or tissue, something of that sort, so that we don't need to use the whole organism. That, of course, is years and years away, but it can be a good goal for us to strive for.
In reading this book, I got the sense that this is just the tip of the iceberg, that we're just starting to learn some of the dimensions of animals' lives, that we're just scratching the surface.
I think so, too. And one reason that we're only beginning to know these things now or to make these discoveries at this time is that we went through a long period for much of the 20th century in which it was basically the scientific consensus that animals did not think, that they had no self-awareness, that they had no ability to reflect on any of their actions, that they basically were born with, you could say, a pre-programmed brain, and they just followed these rote actions or rote instructions. So we know now that that's not the case. I think even many of the researchers who worked in the 50s and 60s on animals and were pretty, you know, what they called strict animal behaviorists. Everything was simply the behavior of the animal. There wasn't necessarily any thought involved. And yet all of those researchers would acknowledge that every animal, even creature, well, it's not a creature, it's just an organism, bacteria, even the bacteria can learn. So that means that an animal is not born with a brain that's pre-programmed, that learning is something that you do that teaches a new instruction to the brain so that it can behave in a flexible manner in a different situation. And all animals are capable of doing this. So that suggests that there's an innate kind of flexibility. How flexible the brain is what we're now beginning to see in animals as researchers take a more evolutionary approach to the study of animal minds.
You started this conversation by talking about how this book came out of a game that you were playing with your dog. What is it about dogs specifically? Because I assume that much of this comes out of almost a comparison, because many of us are so close and have such a close nonverbal relationship with our dogs.
Well, the studies of dogs, that's one of the of a dog's minds is one of the most interesting areas of this new approach, largely because for for almost the entire 20th century, dogs were not regarded as having very much in the way of mental smarts. We denigrated them because they were a domesticated animal. There had been a couple of studies that were done which suggested that they weren't as clever as a wolf, and certainly their brains are smaller than wolves. That's a trend that you see in all domesticated species. Their brains are smaller relative to their body size than those than their feral ancestors. So what changed was a researcher in Hungary and also a researcher here in the United States, Brian Hare. The Hungarian started in the 90s, some years before Brian Hare began his work. But he said he thought that these studies of wolves versus dogs were ridiculous, and what they didn't take into account was the fact that the dog was waiting for an instruction from its master. And that once, for instance, like if a dog and a wolf were put into a gated, closed area, the wolf would figure it out very quickly how to get out of this gate. The dog would just sit there. But he said once you told the dog, go ahead, get out, the dog would do it. So it's just waiting for the permission. And the dog wants to do things with its human. And that's the big transition. So we've brought this other animal. It's like having a mind alongside our own to use and to solve problems in a new way. I mean, how many ways do we use dogs, especially with their ability with their noses, to find things and to do things for us that we can't do, but a dog can very willingly do alongside us. And so his idea, too, was that because of the way dogs have assumed, or through domestication have become so much like us and being willing and loyal and friendly companions, that it mirrored much more the transition from chimpanzee to human than actually studying the chimpanzee mind. That if we study the mind of dogs and how they change from becoming wolves, we are apt to understand a lot more about our own evolutionary history. I think that's just a fascinating idea.
It is indeed fascinating. I do wonder, however, if our interest in this, if we buy into it, I mean, there's dog people and there are cat people and horse people, and I understand that. I'm a dog guy. I love my dog. So is that something that, because I feel that way and because I have that relationship, that I'm curious as to why it becomes almost exclusionary in the sense of,
oh, yes.
Well, it is,
yeah,
about that animal, but maybe not about this animal, and that it's not a more universal feeling. And I've always wondered if it has a lot to do with the fact that some animals just aren't as cute as others.
Well, it's definitely the cute factor is a big one. I mean, most people are very repulsed by looking at the faces of bats, which is too bad because they are very smart animals and able to do many fascinating things. And they have this extraordinary extra sense, you know, their echolocation. So, and as far as pets go, I think people get drawn to maybe something they're exposed to as a child. For myself, I love both dogs and cats. I love horses. You know, I don't have a problem. I find the way that my cat behaves just as fascinating as what my dog does. And so I think a lot of it is just spending time with an animal and allowing it to get to know you, be comfortable with you so that it's not shy and is able to feel free to express itself. Dogs, of course, are much more willing to do that. They've been with us a lot longer than cats have. And cats, I think the latest number on cat domestication is maybe puts them at the most at about 10,000 years ago that we really started to bring cats into our homes. And, you know, they are sort of on the margin between being wild and being domesticated.
The book is fascinating. It is Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. It is published by Crown. Virginia Morell, I thank you very much for sharing with us. I appreciate your time.
It was very much fun. Thanks for great questions.
A delight.
Bye.
Thank you so much. Again, the name of the book is Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. It's published by Crown. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.